we inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. Walker Wildman here with you on the program. It's our Monday edition. We're live, and I was just texting my wife back coming into the program because I have kid duty this afternoon right after the show. And so, you know, the old saying, Bobby, go above and beyond. I don't know where that came from.
I don't know, but it's a good saying.
It is.
You live up to it.
It is. And I've decided as a dad, it's just time for me to go above and beyond. So my wife asked me to get, pick up my three boys. I've got four boys, but pick up three of the four.
Yeah.
When they get out of school at 2 o'clock. But I just replied and said, I've got them all. I've got all the kids all afternoon.
Including Elizabeth.
Yes, including my three-month-old girl. I'm going to try to get her if mom will let me, but they got a pretty tight bond going on. But that's the definition of going above and beyond. Now, about 5 o'clock, I might be regretting it, but for now, above and beyond, I'm going. So that's why that's what I was doing coming into the show, anybody watching online. Glad to have you with us today on the program. The show is hosted each week by myself and Rick Green. We each tag team the show each week. Rick's with you most Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I'm with you on Monday, Wednesday, Friday for the most part. I'll tell you what, next week I'm going to be out a little bit. Fred Jackson's going to be sitting in some. Of course, Rick will be with you as usual. But I'm going to Israel, the Holy Land, next week on Monday, leaving out. Technically leaving out of New York on Tuesday, but I'm heading to New York on Monday. And this is a makeup trip from 2024. And so we're going with about roughly 90 individuals and supporters of AFA to Israel. So that's where I'll be. If you don't hear my voice, that's where I'll be. And next year, we're going to go back with a normal trip. So we'll be opening registration in the coming weeks to Israel. If you want to check out any information about those tours, we do actually have the dates up for both Israel, Boston. We even have a Greece tour coming up, a Footsteps of Paul tour. Those dates are up. So everything you need to know about the tours that we do with my dad, you can go and check that out at wildmangroup.com. Jumping to our scripture for today, Bobby, Greece is on your list, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
Got to do that one.
And Boston, aren't you from that area?
It's been bucketed a while.
Yeah. Yeah. So Boston, Greece.
I would like to make that one again, but you gotta pull priorities, bro.
Yeah, you gotta pick which one you want to do most, right? So we're going to Boston. That registration's open. Boston Freedom Trail. You know, there's over two dozen sites that we're going to in around the Boston area, but the Freedom Trail is the most kind of known, if you will, right there in the heart of Boston. So that's in October of this year. That registration's open. We've already got a bus, one bus booked. I'm going for bus number two now, and then Greece is yet to be open for registration, Greece and Israel for 2026. But you can still get the dates at wildmangroup.com. But Psalm 148 is where we are. If you read this psalm, you just get a all-encompassing picture of God's sovereignty. Verse 1, praise the Lord from heavens, praise Him in the heights. And then we just go through this whole psalm. It's 14 verses, and it talks about God's sovereignty over all of the earth, about the beast of the field, about creeping things, about the birds of the skies, kings of the earth, princes, all judges of the earth. And so if you want an all-encompassing picture, a near all-encompassing picture of God's sovereignty over the earth, go to Psalm 148. It's very powerful. And when you read that, it reminds me of Philippians 2, and there's also some prophetic passages in Isaiah that reference this. But in Philippians 2, this is verses 9 and 10, well, and 11. But In Philippians verse 9, it says, therefore, God has also highly exalted him, talking about Jesus, and given him the name which is above every name. And that the name of Jesus, and that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow, of those in heaven and those on earth and under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. That's verses 9 through 11. And so, the sovereignty of God and the sovereignty of Jesus as the Son of God is perfectly displayed in both Psalm 148, but then in, you know, going on to the New Testament, Philippians 2 talks about this. So, but it just shows how perfectly in sync the First Testament and the Second Testament, or the First Testament and the Last Testament, the old and the new, go together very, very well, perfectly. The Word of God is in harmony and is not contradictory under any circumstance, but perfect harmony is brought with the Word of God. And so Psalm 148 is about the supremacy and the just all-encompassing authority and power of God, our Creator. All right, moving into some of the stories, we do have some guests in the second and the third, so you're not going to want to miss out on that. We'll have Utah State Representative Ken Ivory to talk about federalism and what the states can do to shore up their 10th Amendment rights. And then in the last segment, we'll talk with Reggie Littlejohn about the U.S. withdrawing from the World Health Organization, which is something President Trump did in the last week or two. We'll talk about the UN, some of the problems with the United Nations. But this segment, I want to talk about our the rampant abuse of tax dollars in Washington, D.C. that has been and is being uncovered by DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency. And I told Bobby this morning, there's just so much education that has to take place. So much of what we're going to do on the program over the next 4 years, as President Trump and his team are just chugging away at the rampant abuse and misdeeds in Washington, is we're going to educate people on this show, because a lot of this is just it's just information warfare. That's a fact. Much of this is simply information warfare. Who controls the narrative? Well, for the next 4 years, we're going to control the narrative. And here's why that's important, is because the media is just looking for a scandal. And if they can't find a scandal, they're looking to make up a scandal. How do they do that? Well, they misinform. They spread misinformation. They're the chief purveyors of disinformation and fake news. And we've seen that over and over and over again. So on this Department of Government Efficiency, this is not a rogue agency. It's not even an agency at all. This is an office within the executive office of the president, all right? And President Trump brilliantly repurposed an existing office in the executive branch in the White House, technically in the Eisenhower building next door, but he repurposed this office within the White House, within the executive office of president, and he repurposed it for the purpose of the Department of Government Efficiency. And so, whether it's Elon Musk, and I don't even know if Musk is pulling a salary, he's probably not. But everybody within the Department of Government Efficiency, number one, we're talking about probably dozens of employees. We're not talking about hundreds or thousands. All right, I don't know the official number. I just know they were looking at hiring 45 additional personnel the other day. And it's like, y'all are the smallest office ever in the federal government. You want to hire 45 people? And so this is not some rogue agency. It's not even an agency at all. It's an office within the office of the president. It's under the direct control of the executive branch and the president and the Oval Office, President Trump. And they have a limited time window. I think they're wanting to carry this for about 18 to 24 months and then close it down. So everything about this is 100% up to par. It's 100% legit. It's 100% legal. And it's what President Trump told us he would do. And to that point, look, let's just talk about this for what it is, and that is President Trump is keeping his campaign promise. So let's play. This is going to be clip three. This is President Trump saying that he's doing what he told the voters he would do when sworn in.
Some of your plays have raised some questions and had some pushbacks. 19 states' attorneys general filed a lawsuit, and early Saturday, a judge agreed with them to restrict Elon Musk and his government efficiency team, Doge, from accessing Treasury Department payment and data systems. They said there was a risk of irreparable harm. What do you make of that, and does that slow you down on what you want to do?
No, I disagree with it 100%. I think it's crazy, and we have to solve the efficiency problem. We have to solve the fraud, waste, abuse, all the things that have gone in the government. You take a look at the USAID, the kind of fraud in there,
and you've found significant money's
going.
Things.
Well, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars of money that's going to places where it shouldn't be going, where if I read a list, you'd say this is ridiculous, and you've read the same lists, and there are many that you haven't even seen. It's crazy. It's a big scam. Now, there's some good money, and we can do that through any one of a number. I think I'd rather give it to Marco Rubio over at the State Department. Let him take care of the few good ones. So I don't know if it's kickbacks or what's going on, but the people, look, I ran on this, and the people want me to find it.
Yeah, so I ran on this, and this is what the people want me to do. That's from President Trump. So this isn't surprising. It's not a scandal. And by the way, once again, informational warfare. Despite what the media says, Elon Musk and his team, and by the way, it's not, I need to be careful here. It's not even Elon Musk. It's everybody underneath Elon Musk that's actually doing this work. You think Elon Musk has time to go up in the Treasury building and mosey around in their information systems? Absolutely not. So this is executive branch employees working under Doge, which Musk is heading up, doing this work. But they're not even getting command and control access to these systems. This is important to note. They are getting read-only access into these systems, including the Treasury Department and otherwise. And so it's the agency employees and agency cabinet-level positions that are authorizing any changes in what these agencies are doing, and that's very important to note. Bobby, Doge is just going in and simply being an auditor. They're just reviewing the information and making recommendations to the for example, if we want to say Treasury, the Treasury Department employees are the ones actually making any changes in the system.
Right. Line item by line item. They're just basically over their shoulder of the people who do have access and say, what is this? What is that?
Yes.
Give me some background. And if it's fraudulent, irrelevant, unneeded, it's struck from the budget. Couple of things on Elon. He is a special government employee. That's the title. He does not collect a paycheck, and technically, it's supposed to be a role of no more than 130 days. So we'll see if that's extended or not.
Yep. So Elon Musk not taking a salary from Doge, working directly under the president, special office within the president, and judicial ruling, and folks, this is why judges are so important, and this is why AFA has been working on this leading up to this for the past 2.5 years. But you had one federal judge tell the Doge team that they can't touch any of the Treasury Department systems. This was over the past couple of days. Now, this will be taken to the Supreme Court. This judge will be slapped down like nobody's business. But the reality is that if you tell, think about this logic here. If you're a single judge, you're not even a panel of judges. If you're one judge and you tell Doge that works directly for the president and is working in full conjunction with the Treasury Department and the Treasury Secretary himself that they can't access the Treasury Department systems, what on this earth? No way. No way a federal judge can tell federal agency employees and the cabinet secretary himself that he can't access his own cabinet computer system. Think about the lunacy here, folks. But these judges have no constitutional basis for their actions. They're activist, Marxist, Democrat operatives wearing black robes, calling themselves judges.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of American Family Association and American Family Radio. Hey, just returned from the presidential inauguration of President Trump and Vice President Vance. And let me tell you something, folks. There's an excitement in the air among millions and millions and millions of Americans who are ready for some common sense changes to come to our country. Guess what? We're going to Washington, D.C. again for our Spiritual Heritage Tour in June and September. We're over halfway full. If you want to go with us to see our nation's capital from a distinctively Christian heritage viewpoint, then you need to contact us. You need to go to wildmangroup.com, WILDMONgroup.com. We're also going to Colonial Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to Boston in October. For information on any of these tours, go to wildmangroup.com, WILDMONgroup.com.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the program here on American Family Radio. I'm Walker Wildman here. Please subscribe to the podcast. Help us to spread the word about the program. Just type in the name of the show, At the Core, onto your podcast store or your podcast app, and click the subscribe button. And share the show with family and friends as well. That'll help us get the word out on this show program and all things American Family Radio. Well, speaking of informational warfare and educating the populace on what's going on in our country, we have Representative Ken Ivory from the state of Utah. He's the state representative in Utah. Ken Ivory's with us now. Representative Ivory, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks. Good to be back with you again.
Well, absolutely. Glad to have you on. Representative, federalism. Many people probably heard that word, hopefully have heard that word. Some people have heard of the 10th Amendment and studied up on states' rights. But we're in an era where we really need to capitalize on this momentum politically and constitutionally to ensure that states really take back some of the power that's been taken from them or that they've given away. Tell us about this federalism push.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly right. My speaker called me a couple nights after the election, and he was just excited. And he said, we have the opportunity of our lifetime to restore structure. And if we don't take that opportunity right now, we may never have this opportunity again. He pointed out even blue states are talking about federalism, about this limited nature of the federal government's limited jurisdiction. He says, I want you to come up with a plan. Let's talk about it, lock it in, and let's start moving. He said, I want you out to all the states talking about coordinating this. He says, I want you to start with the blue states. And, you know, I put something together for him. And number one, it involved us as state leaders, legislators, agencies, others, understanding the limited nature of the federal government's limited jurisdiction and the general nature of the state's general governing jurisdiction. Number two, a summit, national summit of states to review that those limits and balance the roles and responsibilities you talked about. Number three, work to the creation of a national federalism commission. There was such a thing from 1952 to 1996, and when they pushed back on unfunded mandates because it was federally funded, they pulled the plug. So we reconstituted of the states, by the states, and those are the basic pillars of a national federalism initiative we're driving from Utah, inviting all states, all people to join with us, because as you said, we've got this amazing opportunity right now, and if we don't take advantage of it, we're going to be answering to our kids and grandkids.
This deterioration of the 10th Amendment and this excessive federal overreach into state functions, if you read our founding fathers, if you read, you know, the Federalist Papers, if you read a lot about America's early days, it's mind-boggling the degree at which the federal government meddles in state functions today. But talk about some of the low-hanging fruit out there about what some of the things that states can do to really push Washington out of their state and restore some semblance of federalism.
Yeah, that's right. Now, first and foremost, it comes right back to us individually. You know, if you're the boss of a company and you rarely show up, you don't know who your employees are, you don't give them the job description, and you don't follow up to see how they're doing, that entity is going to fail 10 out of 10 times. And uniquely in America, we, the people, are the sovereign. James Wilson, teaching George Washington and his cabinet, said the first and fundamental principle in the science of American government is that the people are sovereign. Sadly, about a third of us show up in a general election year. We don't know the state agents that we hire and delegate our sovereignty for them to exercise on our behalf. We don't give them the job description, and we don't follow up. There's a website, iGovern, like iPad, iPhone, iGovern.us, and there are six lessons on there where we teach people what it means that the people are sovereign and how do we exercise this awesome responsibility to heal America. And the promise is we can do that in as little as 5 minutes a week if we do it together. And as far as the low-hanging fruit, we've got to band together, work on these things. We're working to get President Trump to work on a resolution, reinstate the resolution that Reagan did on federalism to keep the agencies in control. They're working on that. But honestly, if we're going to do this long term, it has to be the people directing, teaching as servant leaders, their state leaders, to understand who they are, the nature of their general jurisdiction, to keep the federal government in their limited jurisdiction box. It all starts right with us.
Yeah, and what you're talking about is this joint resolution calling for an executive order on federalism. This is something that Reagan did back in October of 1987, Executive Order 12612, that we're looking for President Trump to engage in or kind of revitalize. Once again, we're talking to Representative Ken Ivory. He's a state representative in Utah. We're talking about federalism and the 10th Amendment. Representative Ivory, let me ask you this. Much of what, not all, but much of what this comes to is down to is federal monies being sent to the states. Really, the money comes from the states, filters through Washington through the income tax and other taxes, and then comes back to the states with all kinds of strings attached. So what's your kind of your opinion on this acceptance of federal dollars at the state level? Because here in Mississippi, we take in a lot of federal money, and of course it comes with strings attached. And I've always been of the, you know, belief that until we get off the federal dole, it's going to really be really hard for us to actually exert power. So what's your input on that, on federal monies?
Yeah, that's right. Almost every state in the nation, their number one source of revenue is federal funds. Number one source of revenue. Imagine you've got a business and your accountants tell you your number one source of income is unsustainable, as the GAO and all the federal auditors tell us all the time. Number one source of funds. But here's the good news and the bad news. Right now, the number two federal expenditure is interest on the debt. Number two. And it grows 10 times faster than everything else. So it's soon to be the number one federal expenditure. The federal monies to the states are going to dry up and go away. It's not something people like to hear, but we can't keep printing and borrowing forever and think we can print our way to prosperity. Yes. And so as states, we have to start getting ready to take care of our own sick people, poor people, elderly people, because they're not going to be able to keep paying for it from the federal side. And so what we're working on now is that constitutional reset of the roles and responsibilities the federal government was never delegated to do in the first place, because we know this is happening. So this dovetails very nicely with the DOGE group and all of the other things that are happening. But this is coming. This isn't even long-term anymore. The Social Security Trust Fund goes dry in less than 8 years now.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's insolvent. And there's a variety of reasons why. One of the reasons is they've been dipping into it to pay for other stuff. But also how the whole thing's structured today is in severe need of reform. But Representative Ivory, on last note, I do want you to address these entitlement programs before we wrap up your interview, because, you know, the left, the media, they fearmonger about, oh, they want to cut your Social Security, they want to cut your Medicaid, et cetera, et cetera. But if we take a hands-off approach to these entitlement programs, we won't really fix the issue long term, the spending issue. So talk a little bit about the entitlement programs.
Yeah, that's right. Long term, this collapses back on the states, and we're going to be the ones to deal with our sick and poor and elderly. And so even talking to my colleagues across the aisle, we understand this is a math problem. This is not a political problem anymore. In Washington, they, on either side, they're not going to bring themselves to be able to fix these big, nasty political issues. But in the states, we know this is coming, and I've got people on both sides of the aisle, leadership on both sides of the aisle in Utah, working on this just as a structural reset. This is hashtag structure, not politics, because we have to restore that structure where we're taking care of the people closest to us, because in Washington, we all know the math. It is alarming. It's devastating. And so in the states, we simply have to get ready and do the hard things, because these are our neighbors. These are the people that live next to us, and we're going to step up and be responsible for that. It's going to be challenging, but we've got to work on that reset of the constitutional roles and responsibilities, because Washington, quite frankly, it's become a favor factory. They've sold us a bill of goods. They can't afford it now. They certainly can't afford it going forward.
Absolutely. Well, Representative Ivory, we appreciate your work on this topic of federalism and raising the point about this joint resolution and this executive order that we hope President Trump puts forth at least pretty soon to really spark this discussion at the state level. Representative Ivory, thanks so much for coming on the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for getting the word out.
Absolutely. That's Utah State Representative Ken Ivory, really an expert on this topic. And I'll get with Bobby. We'll link to a story or two or something on this on the show notes section of the page. But on this note, folks, this is when you start to really understand the financial problem our country is in, it's actually pretty disturbing. And I've covered a lot of this junk over the years, and this is probably on up there, one of the most disturbing facts that I'm aware of in Washington, D.C., when it regards our fiscal status. Because the question now is, you know, with President Trump taking government waste seriously, we're going to see, naturally, we're going to see a reduction in government spending. Maybe not drastic, but we're going to see, I would think, a reduction in government spending just by cutting out waste and abuse. But the question comes is when people say, well, can we balance our budget, right? Can we only spend what we bring in tax receipts and tariffs and other incomes, revenues, from a federal government vantage point, all right? Because if we're talking about having power in Washington, and this may be a little premature, but if we're talking about a J.D. Vance presidency and we're talking about retaining power in the White House for 8 to 12 years, then, you know, eliminating deficit spending is actually on the table. I mean, that's actually a plausible goal, right? The problem is how much our economy has gotten drunk on deficit spending. And when I use the drug addict analogy and weaning an addict off of drugs, addictive drugs, this analogy, there is no better analogy. And so I came across this fascinating thread, and we'll link to this. But there's this outfit called the Kabosi Letter, if I'm pronouncing that right, maybe, I may not be, but who cares at this point. But this Kabosi Letter, it's basically an economic newsletter, and the gentleman whose last name is what the letter is named after, a relatively young guy, but he's just like an expert on all things economy and markets. Very trustworthy source. And this outfit put together a scenario of what it would look like if America eliminated deficit spending, right? Which is that gap of money that we don't have to pay our bills and to run the government, but we print it instead, right? We borrow it against ourselves. We have to be very careful with this, because if the essence of this memo was that if you reduce deficit spending too fast, the entire U.S. economic structure will begin hemorrhaging. It will begin like convulsing. Envision a withdrawal. And so, and if you like extremely reduce deficit spending, like over a year or two, to where you eliminate deficit spending too fast, it could lead to things that you don't even want to think about. We're talking about double-digit drops in GDP that haven't been seen since the Great Depression. And so I talk about on this program how the fight that we're engaged in our country to really preserve this thing called America to, so that we can live to fight another day and so that our children and our grandchildren can experience some semblance of freedom and liberty and prosperity in our homeland, I talk about often how this is not, my friends, a four-year battle. This is a generational fight. This is a 50-year fight. And this whole instance with deficit spending, printing into oblivion, $37 trillion in debt, how do we fix that, is a 50-year fight, my friends. And this specific topic of how quickly can we reduce deficit spending is like exhibit A to this discussion. We need to reduce deficit spending. We need to eventually eliminate deficit spending and run a balanced budget. But we need to, we're going to have to take our time doing this, unfortunately. It's going to take like probably a decade, maybe even longer than that, to reduce deficit spending, eliminate deficit spending without absolutely tanking what is the American economy. And so I just, it's almost like hurry up and wait, right?
It's like weaning a drug addict off of their fix.
It is. You've got to be careful because you could end up killing the patient.
Amen.
If you go too fast. So I only say that because I want us to understand this thing called patience. And this isn't like we need to like let our foot off the pedal. No, my friends. Like we need to replicate the last 3 weeks and make it the next 12 years. But as far as how we go about deconstructing this terrible way that our economy functions with deficit spending, how we deconstruct this, we have to be very careful. It's like remodeling a house. You got to know where the load-bearing walls are here, okay? So this is going to take time and patience, but we can't lose diligence, okay? So don't mix the two.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to the third and final segment of this program. I'm Walker Wildman. This is our latest edition of At the Core. And we had on Representative Ken Ivory out of the state of Utah last segment to talk about federalism and what does it look like for states to wean themselves off of the federal dollar and federal power and control. And, the outlook on the debt is actually not very good. And, you know, there's been this lingering question about how much debt can America go into. And we're starting to see with the inflation being out of control and the interest payments that our country owes now and will owe in the future, and then the entitlement spending, we're starting to kind of see this compounding effect of problems and symptoms that it's going to be challenging to rein it in. I think it can be reined in, but it's going to be very challenging, and I outlined some of that in the last part of the previous segment. But on to a similar topic as far as not states' rights, but the U.S. sovereignty and a lot of these global interests and global entities that the U.S. has been partnering with in recent decades. We have with us Reggie Littlejohn. Reggie is president and founder of the Anti-Globalist International organization. Reggie, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Reggie, the U.S., through President Trump, just days after being in office, withdrew from the World Health Organization. which, you know, is a good thing on so many levels. But talk about that and some of the threats that WHO was posing over the last few years. I know there's been a lot going on with WHO. Basically, Biden wanted to adopt WHO standards for how we handle emergencies and pandemics. But talk about the whole withdrawing from WHO and the what it means for American sovereignty.
Well, I was delighted. I have been advocating for us to withdraw from the World Health Organization since very close to the beginning of the pandemic. Ever since the World Health Organization basically became the mouthpiece for the Chinese Communist Party in terms of repeating their lies, like there wasn't any human-to-human transmission, and that if we were to block flights from China, that would be racist, and that this whole thing evolved from a bat and not from a lab leak. World Health Organization just parroted all of that. And then started adopting Chinese standards of how to handle the whole thing with lockdowns and mask mandates and vaccine mandates and digital health IDs and all the rest of it. So basically, you know, the Chinese Communist Party has an outsized influence on the World Health Organization, which really adopted the China model and was trying to promulgate it worldwide. With the blessing of the Biden-Harris administration. And then in June of last year, they passed some very pernicious amendments to the international health regulations. So one of the amendments had to do with all countries have to surveil their citizens in a variety of ways and then censor them for misinformation and disinformation. And Walker, you know, misinformation and disinformation is anything that disagrees with what the World Health Organization is saying, including things that have since proven to be true, like there is human-to-human transmission. There was likely a lab leak. It was right to cut off travel from China to the rest of the world. You know, so they just want to censor everything that's not their message, and then also institute mandatory health IDs worldwide, which would be digital in our case, and those can be the infrastructure for the China social credit system. And so for all of those reasons, I was just elated that President Trump, as promised, withdrew us from the World Health Organization on day one.
This withdrawal from the WHO, it can't be overstated, Reggie, because as you just outlined, the level of power and control that was going to be assumed by the WHO, even though legally and constitutional, the whole thing's a sham, but Biden's crew was going to submit to it nonetheless. It was outright terrifying what they were going to give them control to and access to. And this is, to your point, on top of the whole handling of COVID by our own government, which was an unmitigated disaster on multiple levels. And a lot of the insanity came from who? Came from WHO as far as lockdowns and all that and wearing masks and stuff. And then Fauci just parroted the talking points. But the United Nations is another entity that I want to get your thoughts on because, unfortunately, the United Nations, while maybe not as much of a bad actor as WHO, has still been doing a lot of the bidding of China and Russia and Iran and a lot of anti-Israel kind of positions that the UN has taken. So what's your thoughts when we're talking about American sovereignty and the future of American diplomacy? What's your input on the United Nations? Should we remain a part of it? What kind of checks and balances should there be? What are your thoughts?
Well, the United Nations, I believe, is every bit as pernicious as the World Health Organization. The World Health Organization is an arm of the United Nations, and the problem is that with the shenanigans that's going on in the United Nations has not been getting the publicity that the shenanigans of the WHO have. So something that most people don't know, that people really need to know, is that on September 22nd of 2024, with the agreement of the Biden administration, the Biden-Harris administration was driving these things both at the World Health Organization and the United Nations. They passed something called the PACT for the Future, PACT, Pact for the Future. And what that does is it gives the United Nations the same kind of tyrannical power as the WHO was going to get or has gotten really through their international health regulations, except we withdrew. So that's great. But specifically, the Pact for the Future provides that in the case of a complex global shock, that's a term that they coined, which could be climate change, it could be the internet going down, it could be a supply chain disruption, could be a major event in outer space. Believe it or not, they actually said that that would be, that they would, that the United Nations would be in the position of directing the global response by an emergency platform that would operationalize automatically. Meaning, because this thing passed in September, they don't have to go back to any of the nations and say, well, this thing happened, so what do you think about this plan? No, it's their directing of how the world responds to it is going to become operational automatically. And this is a way that they can exercise the same kind of tyrannical power via climate change or supply chain disruption as the World Health Organization is wielding up when it comes to, you know, pandemics. So it's a very dangerous situation that almost nobody even knows about.
Let me ask you this. What about the funding? I know President Trump reportedly froze funding to the WHO. What about the U.S. subsidizing the UN? Because I don't know about the whole legal aspect of withdrawing from the UN. You know, is that something that you would need Congress to weigh in on, or can the executive branch and the commander in chief, as the chief executive officer, can he just simply say, you know, we're not engaging with the UN anymore, or we're withdrawing financial support of? What would that look like, practically speaking?
Well, okay, so practically speaking, I don't know. All of these things are very difficult. Like, for example, the World Health Organization, they don't have anything in there about how to withdraw. Okay.
Wow.
So fortunately, the United States has a carve out where when we joined, we said we can withdraw on a year's notice if we're all paid up. But I don't know that. I don't think any other country has that. So then you have to look into, you know, the international law of treaties, you know, the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, and cobble together a case about how we would withdraw. So I just said how pernicious the United Nations is, and it would be very easy to say, you know, I think that we should just withdraw from the UN, get the U.S. out of the UN, get the UN out of the U.S., you know. And I have a lot of sympathy for that position. The only problem is that at the United Nations, we have a seat with veto power on the United Nations Security Council, and we would be giving that up.
Yeah.
So it's delicate. It's something that is going to require really sort of expert navigation. But I think that they're mostly bad actors over there. I'm not saying every single person that works at the UN is a bad actor. What I'm saying is the Pact for the Future is a recipe for international disaster and is certainly destructive of U.S. sovereignty.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to talk through like the practical implications of a withdrawal, because it's easy, to your point, to parrot some talking points about withdrawing from the UN, and it doesn't mean that, you know, we don't support withdrawing from the UN, but we got to really think this thing through because of that veto power that you mentioned. Now funding is something that we could, you know, look at and stop without putting into jeopardy our membership and vote, that unilateral veto vote that you mentioned, because we're spending somewhere between 18 and 20 billion. That was the latest numbers I got. To kind of subsidize the UN. So it's possible we reduce or eliminate that funding, but still maintain our seat for the sake of that veto vote. But what's your, before we let you go, what are you looking for from President Trump as far as next moves, whether it's the United Nations or any of these other type of global actors that threaten American sovereignty? What are you looking for out of the White House?
Well, President Trump unfortunately made a statement, and I hope that he was just, you know, being casual about it, but he said that he might consider rejoining the World Health Organization if they would clean it up. And I don't think that it can be cleaned up. I mean, I believe that it was rotten from its inception, and I just want to give you a quote from the first director general of the World Health Organization. His name was Brock Chisholm. Here's the first director general. He said, to achieve world government, which is obviously, you know, was his aim, it is necessary to remove from the minds of men their individualism, loyalty to family traditions, national patriotism, and religious dogmas. Mm. Now, Brock Chisholm was a psychiatrist, so I don't know how he proposed to remove from the minds of men, you know, our individuality, our loyalty to family, our patriotism, and our religion. But that's frightening, and I would ask President Trump to basically not listen to the people who have risen up and said, oh, let's not withdraw from the World Health Organization. Let's try to reform it. It can't be reformed. It is irredeemably corrupt, to say nothing of the fact that it is, you know, we'll talk about funding. It is funded in a major part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Gavi, and other pharmaceutical-related entities. And so what is the World Health Organization doing trying to tell us whether or not we need vaccines when they're being funded by people who would profit hugely from vaccines? So I would urge President Trump to remain firm in his decision to withdraw us from the World Health Organization.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we'll save upwards of about $1 billion to $1.5 billion because we're funding about 20% of their budget, which their budget's about $7 billion. And so we'll save about $1 to $1.5 billion from not funding the WHO. And I agree, they're such a bad actor. There is nothing redeemable about the World Health Organization. Once again, we've been talking to Reggie Littlejohn. Reggie is founder and president of the Anti-Globalist International Organization. Reggie, thanks so much for coming on the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Reggie. That's Reggie Littlejohn, founder and president of Anti-Globalist International. Really an expert on all things World Health Organization, United Nations, globalism, the threat to American sovereignty. Fascinating topic there. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. There's zero purpose in rejoining the World Health Organization under any circumstance. Absolutely not. These globalist entities are actually the entire kind of thinking behind global entities is problematic at its inception, okay? Even the United Nations. Because if you look at, you can say, well, they were founded for good purposes. Well, no, that's not going to cut it. That's not a good enough articulation for me, my friend, to just settle this debate, okay? Because when you look at the really unbiblical nature of globalism, let's just put it that way, and you look at the unbiblical nature of the New World Order, and these are not buzzwords that I created or Alex Jones created. These are buzzwords that your George Soros's, your Bill Gates, your World Economic Forum, these are their buzzwords, okay? They created the buzzwords like New World Order, things like that. When you look at these, when you look at the thinking behind global entities, it's very much unbiblical, and I could bring on somebody that's way more expert in this area than me. But my point is just when you look at the scriptures about God establishing nations, establishing boundaries, establishing kings, taking down kings from power, there is no biblical backing for globalism and national nations relegating their self-governing authority to some unelected global entity. That's pretty much a summation of the anti-globalist viewpoint when it comes to Christianity. So a lot of problems here. And you can look at existing examples of these global entities trying to do quote-unquote good things, and it turns into an absolute dumpster fire. We'll see you next time. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show. That's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you. We need to save them. That is why we have partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears the heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies, and that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or 140 helps rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just call #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.